process. Art restoration requires intensive research and training and loads of skill. But imagine the anxiety while professionals embark on restoring rare paintings. Under careful supervision, French restorers are working to give back to 500-year-old paintings their former glory. They were rescued from a fire that engulfed the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris in 2019. These works date back from the 17th and early 18th century. The paintings, including 22 with large format, were temporarily stored in a warehouse and now being restored at an undisclosed location. The fire caused strictly no damage to the paintings, but they have accumulated thick layers of dirt and smoke on the surface after hanging in the cathedral for centuries. Some of the works also have paint loss due to overcleaning that restorers say need to be repaired elegantly.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Democrats have called for an investigation into flights which took Venezuelan asylum seekers from Texas to Martha's Vineyard under allegedly false pretenses. Please stay with us for more. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. Democratic lawmakers have called on the US Justice Department to investigate whether Florida and Texas officials broke any federal laws when they moved dozens of Venezuelan asylum seekers from Texas to Martha's Vineyard under allegedly false pretenses. The letter from the congressional representatives, Jerry Connolly, Sylvia Garcia, Ted Lieu, and dozens of other Democrats followed the emergence of a report in which a 27-year-old Venezuelan said he was paid $200 by a mystery figure known as Perla to find people outside the San Antonio Migrant Center in Texas to board a flight. The Venezuelan migrant, who was called Emmanuel, told the San Antonio Report that he gave Perla contact information for at least 10 other migrants. As the federal government retains jurisdiction over cases that involve interstate travel, we request the Department of Justice to investigate whether any federal funds were used to operate a fraudulent scheme and request the Department of Justice make a determination as to whether officials in both Texas and Florida violated federal laws, the letter said. At least one criminal investigation has already been opened up into the situation by a Texas sheriff. And Congressional Representative Jerry Connolly and others say the Justice Department should do the same. Multiple media reports have depicted how the asylum seekers had been misled once they arrived in Texas and were incorrectly told they were being flown to Boston, Massachusetts. It is alleged that immigration officials knowingly falsified mailing addresses for the migrants by selecting arbitrary homeless shelters across the United States, with the expectation that migrants would be required to contact the wrong agency, the letter said. Details have not yet emerged about the planning and execution of the plan, which was spearheaded by the office of the Florida governor, Ron DeSantis. Ron DeSantis has defended his administration's actions and denied that migrants were misled by him or his administration. The Democrats pointed out that the migrants were used in what was called a political stunt, where fleeing communism, authoritarianism, and violence, having walked thousands of miles for what they called a dignified life. U.S. Justice Department officials have so far declined to comment. The website commondreams.org has more on this story. More than 40 House Democrats on Friday, 23rd of September, urged the Biden Justice Department to open up an investigation into Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's inhumane scheme that transported dozens of migrants to Martha's Vineyard, alleging the Republican leader and other officials involved may have violated federal laws. Harrowing interviews and reports reveal officials in Florida intentionally misled the migrants to believe they would be flown to Boston, Massachusetts to receive expedited work papers, the 44 Democratic lawmakers wrote in a letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland. Instead, the deceived migrants were packed onto buses, put onto two privately chartered flights, and prohibited from taking photographs of the journey that made two unannounced stops before landing in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, the letter continues. It is alleged that immigration officials knowingly falsified mailing addresses for the migrants by selecting arbitrary homeless shelters across the United States, with the expectation that migrants would be required to attend court proceedings as early as next week in states thousands of miles away or face forced removal. Spearheaded by Representative Jerry Connolly, Sylvia Garcia, Ted Lieu, and Mondaire Jones, the letter calls on the Justice Department to investigate whether any federal funds were used to operate a fraudulent scheme and requests the Department of Justice make a determination as to whether officials in both Texas and Florida violated federal laws. The actions of the officials in Texas and Florida were not only fundamentally cruel and uniquely un-American, there remains a likelihood that federal laws were indeed violated, the House Democrats wrote. Dozens of migrants arrived in Massachusetts last week after Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, in partnership with the GOP-aligned aviation firm Vertol Systems, arranged for them to be flown to Martha's Vineyard from San Antonio, Texas, using human beings as props for political messaging. A Texas sheriff on Monday launched a criminal investigation into the ploy, which he said preyed upon the vulnerable migrants. Texas's Republican Governor Greg Abbott, who has engaged in similar schemes, insists he wasn't involved in the flights organized by the Florida government. On Tuesday, some of the Venezuelan asylum seekers filed a federal class action lawsuit, alleging that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and Florida's Transportation Secretary designed and executed a premeditated, fraudulent and illegal scheme centered on exploiting this vulnerability for the sole purpose of advancing their own personal, financial and political interests. Numerous state-level officials, including Massachusetts Representative Dylan Fernandez, have demanded a federal probe, characterizing the Florida governor's actions as fraud, kidnapping, deprivation of liberty, and human trafficking. Members of Massachusetts' congressional delegation, meanwhile, have pressured the U.S. Treasury Department to investigate the matter, citing possible abuse of federal funds. Additionally, Florida State Senator Jason Pizzo, a Democrat, has filed a lawsuit aiming to bar Ron DeSantis from spending any more taxpayer money under migrant flights. In their letter on Friday, the 44 House Democrats stressed that the federal government retains jurisdiction over cases that involve interstate travel and should intervene. The Baxter County, Texas Sheriff's Office has already opened a criminal investigation into this scheme, they wrote. We urge your department to do the same and conduct a thorough investigation and deliver accountability to those that violated the law.
Queen and the royal family.
Part 1.
The British royal family, an institution instantaneously recognizable throughout the world. Positioning itself as both the face and heart of Britain. The monarchy purports to perform a dual role. Promote British interests on the global stage and at the same time sustain and justify its own institutional relevance. The royal family sets out to perform these apparently complementary roles by projecting a carefully crafted and jealously guarded image of propriety, diligence and unflinching pursuit of duty. To that end, the British monarchy goes to extraordinary lengths to discourage, distract, and disrupt any real scrutiny of its true role and performance. But keeping up appearances is not always an easy task. The recent controversy surrounding the estrangement of Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle is just the latest line of scandals engulfing the royal family in the past 3 decades. Much to the Queen's dismay, the so-called Harry and Meghan saga has depicted the royal family in a poor light. The most serious charge relating to allegations of racism, initially directed at Meghan Markle, whose mother is African-American, and then more ominously towards her baby. As Meghan Markle recounted to Oprah Winfrey in the now famous interview in March 2021, an anonymous senior member of the royal family was concerned how brown her baby was going to be. There was widespread speculation that the anonymous racist at the top of the royal family was none other than the new deceased Duke of Edinburgh, husband to Queen Elizabeth for 74 years. The notorious escapades of Princess Diana, wherein the estranged wife of Prince Charles engaged in multiple extramarital affairs, was arguably the first time in modern times that the carefully managed moral reputation of the British royal family was shattered in front of a global audience. Similar to Meghan Markle, the late Princess Diana informed the world of her pain and anguish through a hard-hitting interview with BBC Panorama in November 1995. The description that Diana provided of the royal family nearly 3 decades ago is eerily similar to its recent depiction by Meghan Markle. Both accounts present the British monarchy as a cold, distant, and unfeeling organisation, which not only demands total obedience from its members, but by extension, It goes to extreme lengths to discredit those who are perceived to have broken the rules. Strategic heavy lift capability. Both Diana and Meghan are perceived to have broken the rules, and very quickly the two women were ostracized and cast as outsiders. Diana would ultimately pay with her life for daring to criticize and expose the royals. And as for Meghan Markle, it remains to be seen what fate awaits her. For if Mohammed Al-Fayed, the billionaire father of Princess Diana's late lover, Dodi Fayed, is to be believed, Princess Diana, alongside her lover Dodi, was murdered by the British Secret Service MI6 on the instructions of the monarchy. The allegations could be dismissed as a conspiracy theory, was the only one making them, but he is not. Even former MI6 officers have made the same allegations, and in the process, supplying credible details to support their incendiary claims. It is now widely suspected that Henry Paul, the deputy head of secretary at Ritz Hotel in Paris, who was driving Diana and her lover Dodi on that fateful late August night, was a long-standing MI6 agent. If indeed the Queen had given a nod and a wink to her Secret Service to deal decisively with the increasingly troublesome Diana, then there was a much bigger message conveyed by that suspected murder. You cross the British monarchy at your own peril.
Your Majesty's guard is ready to march off, ma'am.
To gauge the extent the Queen will go to protect her interests, the best place to start is the great name change of 1917, which enabled the British monarchy to conceal its German roots. By all credible accounts, the great majority of the British people are unaware of the distant roots of the monarchy. Since the accession of Queen Elizabeth II to the throne in 1952, the British establishment has tried hard to depict the monarchy as a quintessentially British institution. However, the reality is very different. The name change from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor was effected by King George V at the height of World War I, at a time when the British public were understandably alienated by German names. From this cynical name change, it can be deducted that there is nothing uniquely British about the royal family. Therefore, Tony Blair's assertion that the Queen and her entourage represent continuity in British public life is yet another cynical deception perpetrated against the British people. The Queen may project an image of quintessential Britishness, but it is doubtful that deep down she still doesn't feel a fondness for Germany, not necessarily contemporary liberal Germany, but the Germany of old, specifically the Teutonic way of life of the 19th century. Let's not forget that the longest reigning British monarch, Queen Victoria, who ruled for nearly 64 years, died in the arms of a German emperor, Kaiser Wilhelm II. Who, astonishingly enough, was her grandson on the Isle of Wight in 1901.
As a child, I never imagined that one day a man would walk on the moon.
The royal family reportedly continues to celebrate Christmas the German way by opening presents after afternoon tea on Christmas Eve, which falls on December 24th. By contrast, the British people open presents on Christmas morning, December 25th, typically before breakfast. Although these quirks might be dismissed on the grounds of sentimentalism and nostalgia, but the story gets much more sinister. Britain's shortest reigning monarch, Edward VIII, whose 11th-month reign in 1936 coincided with the policy of appeasement towards Nazi Germany, is a case in point. Edward was well known for his pro-German political sympathies. "Every drop of blood in my veins is German," Edward VIII is reported to have boasted to pro-German activist Diana Mitford, arguably the most accomplished of the notorious Mitford sisters and the then wife of British fascist leader Sir Oswald Mosley. Germany's ambassador to the court of St. James's, the prominent Nazi Joachim von Ribbentrop, who was German foreign minister throughout World War II, even called Edward V half-German on account of the king's effusive pro-German sympathies, if not his mastery of the German language and cultural mores. Indeed, Edward VIII was no ordinary appeaser, insofar as he actively supported the German cause in the 1930s. His support for Nazi Germany started very early, no later than the foundation of the Nazi regime in 1933, when as Prince Edward he encouraged the young princesses, Margaret and Elizabeth, to give Nazi salutes while on a visit to Germany. It is equally noteworthy that, like his brother before him, King George VI was an admirer of Hitler and the Nazis, and an active supporter of the policy of appeasement, which historians blame for the outbreak of war in Europe in September 1939. It has often been said that had Edward VIII been an ordinary citizen, he would most likely have been charged with his treason and swiftly executed following the conclusion of World War II in Europe in May 1945. Another element of Britishness is, without doubt, the Treason Act of 1351, one of the oldest pieces of legislation still on the statute books. At the same time, this ancient law is emblematic of the royal family's disregard, if not contempt, for the body of ancient English laws which it claims to uphold. One quirk of this ancient law is that it constitutes high treason to violate the wife of the king's eldest son, or in contemporary terms, the queen's son, which in this case happens to be Prince Charles. Based on this law, multiple prosecutions could have been launched against the various men, notably Army Major James Hewitt, who entered into consensual romantic and sexual liaisons with the late Princess Diana, the wife to heir apparent to the throne, Prince Charles. Despite her widespread popular appeal, Princess Diana was known to be promiscuous and had affairs with multiple men, including James Gilby, the heir to a large gin fortune, Etonian art dealer Oliver Hoare, rugby player Will Carling, the Pakistani heart and lung surgeon Hasnat Khan. There were even rumours she had an affair with John Kennedy Jr., the late son of John F. Kennedy. Incidentally, until 1814, the penalty for high treason was death by hanging, drawing and quartering, thereafter reduced to death by hanging. Ignoring the Treason Act indicates that the British monarchy is more than willing and able to engage in legal manoeuvrings, even to the extent of seriously compromising the rich tapestry of ancient and modern laws and norms, which underpin the UK's unwritten constitution, in order to stay afloat. The Princess Diana saga, which only concluded with her untimely death in 1997, is just one example amongst many. Prince Andrew is yet another and much more contemporaneous example. The errant prince is wanted in the US for questioning in relation to the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, which saw multiple underage girls abused by the deceased American financier. Prince Andrew, or until very recently the Duke of York to give him his formal royal title, was a close confidant of the American paedophile Jeffrey Epstein, who chose to commit suicide in a lonely prison cell instead of facing the music for his shocking crimes. The Duke of York abused his royal privilege for more than 2 years to avoid accountability in a formal setting, and all the while the Queen said nothing about the whole sordid affair, before she finally caved in to public pressure and stripped her son of all titles and charities. But then again, Prince Andrew has form when it comes to corruption and scandal. Dubbed Air Miles Andy on account of his extravagant billing arrangements, it is reported that in 2003 alone, he racked up £325,000 flying around the world, including using a helicopter to fly to Oxford and misusing RAF planes to fly to Scotland to play golf. To make matters worse, his former wife, the scandal-prone Sarah Ferguson, caused deep embarrassment to the Queen when she was exposed by a News of the World sting operation in 2010, in which she promised to arrange access to Prince Andrew, who was then the UK's special trade envoy, in exchange for £500,000 in cash. The royal family has struggled with issues of nationality and political allegiance. It could be said they have an easier relationship with religion and religious identity. Easier in the sense that the Act of Settlement 1701, whose cardinal aim was to ensure a Protestant succession to the English throne, places a prohibition on Catholics ascending to the crown as kings or queens. Astonishingly, this act is still religiously adhered to, and the British monarch is presented as defender of the faith, as in Protestantism. But the offence and discrimination this act inflicts is no longer limited to Roman Catholics, as the demographic and cultural diversity of Britain has hugely expanded since the early 1950s. Modern Britain is home to millions of people of non-Christian backgrounds, notably Muslims and Hindus. Since the early 1980s, the British government, in tandem with large business organisations and civil society writ large, has gone out of its way to place diversity at the pivot of its domestic policies. This attitude has given rise to an idiosyncratic British concept of multiculturalism, which purports to promote equality of opportunity amongst the UK's diverse demographic groups. But is the Queen's status of defender of the faith consistent with this policy? More broadly, the religious issue, although highly symbolic, is just one example among many where the Queen is seriously out of step with developments in British society. To properly integrate this disparity in royal values in British society, the best place to start is the political realm. The UK likes to project itself as the world's oldest democracy, taking special pride in its parliamentary roots.
Hundreds of respondents took part in the Stoke-on-Trent.
Supporters of the British establishment never tire of reminding the world that their core parliament, the House of Commons, is the oldest such institution in the world. This is a myth, of course, as there are many ancient parliaments out there, such as the Swedish Parliament or the Riksdag, some of which predate the House of Commons by decades and even centuries. Pedantic disputes aside, the modern House of Commons is generally recognised as a democratic institution, as demonstrated by the rigorous section and election processes, which take place before someone from whichever political party takes up his or her place in Parliament. And yet these very same people have to not only swear an oath of allegiance to an unelected monarch, but worse still, throughout their tenure, they are forced to demonstrate defence to the royal family, often against their own best judgment. At least for the past 120 years, there have been professed Republicans who are against the monarchy establishment in the House of Commons and, lesser still, in the House of Lords. There are not many of them, but the fact they are there and are forced to swear an oath of allegiance to the Queen introduces a degree of hypocrisy into the British political process.
I swear by Almighty God that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth. her heirs and successors according to law.
Worse still, the fact that MPs are forced to swear an oath of allegiance to the Queen is the strongest indicator that all legal and constitutional means for removing the Queen and the royal family have been closed off. Short of a revolution, the British people simply cannot overthrow their unelected rulers. The Queen, of course, does not reciprocate in kind, insofar as she does not swear an oath to uphold parliamentary democracy, let alone serving the people. But the real picture is much worse than that, inasmuch as every major British institution, from the military down to the prison system, is trapped in this unreciprocated oath of allegiance. On account of this comprehensive hegemony, how can stalwarts of the British establishment claim the Queen is bereft of political power and yet keep a straight face at the same time? At this juncture, it is necessary to gauge an accurate picture of the extent of the Queen's powers. Just how powerful is she, and to what extent can the monarchy affect the tide of British destiny? The simple answer, of course, is that the Queen and her heirs have tremendous powers, which affect the daily lives of Britons and, to a lesser extent, the citizens of those countries where the Queen is still nominally head of state, notably Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. In keeping with British tradition, where subtlety and discretion are prized characteristics, the monarchy exercises political power through ancient and seemingly innocuous-sounding institutions. One such institution is the Privy Council, officially a body comprised of senior politicians whose job is to advise the Queen on the exercise of the royal prerogative. For one thing, the Privy Council remains a secretive arm of the state, with a set of traditions and rituals that come close to Masonic theatrics. And at the centre of its official business is the Queen herself, who is physically present every time the Council meets to utter the words approved or referred in order to direct or influence policy proposals. In short, the Privy Council constitutes the principal vehicle by which the royal prerogative is enforced. In the words of the former Liberal Democrat MP turned establishment critic, Norman Baker, the Privy Council is effectively a one-person law-making, decision-taking machine. The royal prerogative, whose spirit and functions are embodied in the Privy Council, has multiple layers, with each layer in turn producing multiple, if not countless, powers and privileges. For instance, the prerogative of perfection is a function which confers personal immunity on the sovereign from ever being sued in the courts. The Queen is quite literally above the law. If the Privy Council represents the hard edge of the Queen's far-reaching powers, then the honours system constitutes the soft core of her barely concealed, all-encompassing influence. Going back all the way to 1348, with the establishment of the Order of Chivalry against the backdrop of the Black Death Plague, Britain's honours system enables the Queen to maintain the country's social and economic hierarchy. By doling out honours, indirectly by way of the government, the Queen confers favours and recognition to those whom she approves of. Officially designed to distinguish between different degrees of achievement and service, the honours system actually performs the opposite by conferring recognition on those the establishment, and by extension the Queen, seeks to promote and elevate. But the honours system, like every feature of British public life, is vulnerable to deep corruption. In the Cash for Honours scandal of 2006 to 2007, for instance, honours and peerages for the House of Lords were offered to individuals who had made large financial donations to the then ruling Labour Party.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
The Presidential Election Reform Act, which aims to prevent another January 6th-style insurrection, passed with the support of every House Democrat present. But in the end, only 9 Republicans supported the measure. Please stay with us for more. Common Dreams website has more on this story. House Democrats on Wednesday, 21st of September, took aim at the overwhelming majority of their Republican colleagues in the lower chamber, who voted against proposed legislation that aims to prevent another attempt to use Congress to subvert presidential elections. The Presidential Elections Reform Act, written by Representatives Liz Cheney, a Republican from Wyoming, and Zoe Lofgren, a Democrat from California, seeks to prevent presidents from manipulating the Electoral Count Act, like former President Donald Trump, and his attempt to do so as part of his effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election and prevent the peaceful transfer of power to President Joe Biden. The measure passed by a vote of 229 to 203, with every House Democrat present voting in favour. Only 9 House Republicans joined them. All 9 are leaving Congress after this term, either because they have lost their primary challengers or because they're retiring. In addition to Liz Cheney, there are Representatives Anthony Gonzalez of Ohio, Jamie Herrera Butler of Washington, Chris Jacobs of New York, John Katko of New York, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, Peter Meyer of Michigan, Tom Rice of South Carolina, and Fred Upton of Michigan. To all those who oppose this legislation, I ask you, how could anyone vote against free and fair elections, the cornerstone of our Constitution? House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who leads the party that has repeatedly fought to keep more progressive challengers off ballots and out of debates across the country, said on Wednesday on the House floor, "How could anyone vote against our founders' vision, placing power in the hands of the people?" she added. "How could anyone vote against their own constituents, allowing radical politicians to rip away their say in our democracy?" In a swipe at Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican from Wisconsin, Representative Mark Pocan, a Democrat from Wisconsin, tweeted that the newly passed bill eliminates loopholes insurrectionists tried to exploit on 6th of January 2021, even for those who only spent a couple of seconds trying to overthrow democracy. Speaking of his 203 GOP colleagues who voted against the bill, Representative Jim McGovern, a Democrat from Massachusetts, chair of the House Rules Committee, told Politico website that the idea that they're siding with insurrectionists They're siding with people who are trying to undermine our democracy is really disgusting. Politico reports that some House Republicans could be open to supporting a Senate version of the legislation introduced in July by Senators Joe Manchin and Shelley Moore Capito, which might include provisions of the lower chamber's bill. Senator Joe Manchin's office confirmed on Wednesday that his bill has at least 10 Republican co-sponsors, enough GOP votes for filibuster-free passage. The Associated Press has more on this story, but from a different angle. The Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell said on Tuesday, 27th of September, he would proudly support legislation to overhaul rules for certifying presidential elections, bolstering a bipartisan effort to revise a 19th century law and avoid any repeat of the 6th of January 2021 insurrection. The legislation would clarify and expand parts of the 1887 Electoral Count Act, which, along with the Constitution, governs how states and Congress certify electors and declare presidential winners. The changes in the certification process are in response to unsuccessful efforts by Donald Trump and his allies to exploit loopholes in the law and overturn his 2020 defeat by Joe Biden. Mitch McConnell made the remarks just before a committee vote on the legislation. He said he would back the bill as long as a bipartisan agreement on the language was not significantly changed. Congress's process for counting the presidential electors' votes was written 135 years ago, Mitch McConnell said. The chaos that came to a head on 6th of January 2021 certainly underscored the need for an update. Mitch McConnell noted that in addition to Republican objections to Biden's win, Democrats objected the last three times that Republicans won presidential elections. The legislation would make it harder for Congress to sustain those objections. A total of 147 Republicans in the House and Senate objected to results in key states won by Joe Biden. Handfuls of Democrats objected to Donald Trump's victory in 2016, and to George W. Bush's victories in 2000 and 2004. We continue with the Associated Press's coverage of the same story. Mitch McConnell's comments gave the legislation a major boost as its bipartisan sponsors pushed to pass the bill before the end of the year and the next election cycle. Donald Trump is still lying about the election fraud as he considers another run for presidency. The House has passed a more expansive bill overhauling electoral rules, but it has far less Republican support. While the House bill received just 9 votes from Republican members, the Senate version has the backing of at least 12 Republicans, more than enough to break a filibuster and pass the legislation in the 50-50 Senate. The Senate Rules Committee was expected to approve the legislation on Tuesday and send it to the full chamber. A vote isn't expected until after the November's midterm elections. Senators were expected to make minor tweaks to the legislation, but keep the bill largely intact. The bill, written by Republicans Susan Collins of Maine and Joe Manchin of West Virginia, a Democrat, would make clear that the vice president only has a ceremonial role in the certification process, tighten the rules on states sending votes to Congress, and make it harder for lawmakers to object. Donald Trump publicly pressured states, members of Congress, and his vice president Mike Pence to undo Joe Biden's win. Even though Trump's efforts failed, lawmakers in both parties said his attacks showed the need for stronger safeguards in the law. The bill would be the strongest legislative response yet to the 6th of January attack on Congress, in which hundreds of Donald Trump supporters beat police officers, broke into the Capitol, and interrupted as lawmakers were counting the votes. Once the rioters were cleared, the House and Senate rejected GOP objections to the vote in two states. Differences between the House and Senate bills will have to be resolved before final passage, including language and congressional objections.
Hidden Files.
Soft power, ceremonial role, strictly neutral. These are some of the terms we've heard over and over again when talking about the role of Elizabeth II, who was the queen of some 32 countries during her lifetime. Upon her death a few weeks ago, much trivia has been published about the Queen, from her love for the corgi breed of dogs and ownership of British dolphins and swans to details of the countless official rituals to be held for her funeral procession. Well, perhaps the closest mainstream media has come to the Queen's colonial rule during the past few weeks is a discussion over the gems on her crown, all of which were stolen reminders of British colonial history. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. And today, together, we will have a trip around the world to remember a part of the Queen's biography that's seldom seen in mainstream media. But first, let's take a look at the not-so-ceremonial roles officially played by the late Queen Elizabeth.
As the Queen of England and other states, Queen Elizabeth II had various official roles and responsibilities. She was the Commander-in-Chief of the British Armed Forces, meaning she was the supreme command authority. She even had the power to issue orders to the Prime Minister and the Defense Minister. She could decide when to start or end a war. Queen Elizabeth II was also the head of the Church of England. But regardless of these and other powers, the cost of which can affect millions, the Queen was exempted from paying the price of her decisions. And yet, she was exempted from paying taxes.
Regarding what many say is the ceremonial role of the Queen, there is an interesting quote from an Irish activist, James Connolly, almost a century ago during British King George's reign. He says, quote, "We will not blame him for the crimes of his ancestors if he relinquishes the royal rights of his ancestors, but as long as he claims their rights by virtue of descent, and by virtue of descent, he must shoulder the responsibility of their crimes." Well, this is an interesting perspective when we look at the 70 years reign of Queen Elizabeth II. The British Empire after World War I was at its peak and was ruling over 23% of the people on Earth and one-fourth of the landmass. By the time Elizabeth II took over, the empire had started to decrease in size. This was especially true during the 1960s when many countries declared their independence from London. And though the crown's influence started to wane, even after declarations of independence, the queen still exerted much influence over former colonies and was quite aggressive when it felt that its interests were at stake anywhere in the world, from Kenya to the Falkland Islands. And by the time of her death, the British Commonwealth now consists of 15 countries, with a few currently wanting to totally separate from the British crown. And coming up shortly, we will welcome Dr. Rebecca Masterton to the program.
Rebecca Masterton. Dr. Masterton holds a master's in comparative East Asian and African literature. In her PhD that she received from the University of London, Dr. Masterton critiqued the effects of secularism and colonialism upon traditional Islamic teachings. As a professor and writer, she has been teaching for some 20 years and lectured widely at conferences in Europe, Canada, and the United States. She has also worked in media for 16 years, producing and presenting several hundred programs.
Well, thanks so much for being with us and welcome to the program, Dr. Masterton. I'd like to hear your overall thoughts about the reactions that we've been seeing in the media and elsewhere since the death of the Queen.
To be honest, I have been quite surprised at how a lot of ex-colonized countries have been so full of praise and admiration and devotion to the Queen, because we've had decades of campaigns for independence from the British monarchy, a lot of suffering and bloodshed because of that. And I have to say, it's taken me by surprise at how people from countries, you know, whose ancestors died fighting to free themselves from British domination, those countries are now, for example, I heard, I haven't confirmed, but Bangladesh is apparently holding 3 days mourning for the Queen. So I've heard that people in different African countries are also very upset and crying. And I know someone posted up an article on Twitter exploring this kind of emotional, psychological contradiction that's going on. Like, why do people hate oppression, but they seem to be admiring the oppressor so much at this time? So yeah, there's been a big, it's been a big outpouring, as I've seen, and of course, very orchestrated. It's all been planned for years, I guess. And people are falling for the hype.
Well, some say that the Queen had a ceremonial role only and had no control over British politics. I mean, your thoughts in general on this?
I've seen on social media people saying, yeah, but the monarchy, it's just ceremonial. It's doesn't have, you know, why are you feeling so passionately about it? It's just symbolic. But we can see, again, according to reports, that the monarchy has been instrumental in attracting business to the UK. So the monarchy has been instrumental in the sales of arms to Arabia, you know, huge arms deals. We know that Prince Charles, or now King Charles, has done this strange sword dance with the Saudi monarchy. And some people say, well, he loves Islam and he's spoken in favor of Islam. But so far, I haven't heard him speak up about Yemen as an example. So, and we know, as you know, the Queen recently knighted Tony Blair, who has been intensely hated in the UK for his role in the Iraq war, for the destruction that caused, and the lies and the deception. Not only that, but because, for the fact that he set himself up as a kind of a consultant that can polish up the image of various dictators around the world. That's how he sold himself. And the Queen knighted him quite covertly. But I think people, they somehow want this figure. They want the monarchy to be a certain way, so they're willing to edit out a lot of the glaring red flags. They want to hold this fantasy in front of them, maybe to forget the fact that their fuel bills are going through the roof.
Well, you know, the Queen could be equated, obviously, with privilege, luxury, and elitism, and obviously quite opposite from the day-to-day of the average British person, as you were just saying. So when we see support from the lower strata of society, how do you explain that overall?
A lot of the people waiting to pass by the front of the palace, you can tell, like, these are hardworking, sort of lower strata in the society people, and it often seems, as you say, that they are the most devoted to the monarchy. And I think it comes down to, well, if you don't have a large salary, at least you can somehow have pride in being British, as an example. So having pride in the monarchy gives you something to be proud of, even if you're living in dire circumstances. But I was just saying to my friend, like, it's so ironic that the people queuing here to come in front of the palace and pay their respects. I mean, I said to my friend, like, what has she ever done for them? How has this monarchy actually improved the lives of people just in London? There's so much poverty in London. It's, you know, it's a bad situation. We've got a lot of homelessness here, not like in the US, but still there's a lot of homeless. I met a homeless man on the street just a few days ago, and he had something to do with the military. A lot of military are on the streets. But he was saying how everybody loves the Queen, you know? And I was thinking, but so you're homeless, but you're saying how you love the Queen. And I just kept silent. I just thought, I don't want to get into an argument here, so I'm just going to keep silent. Yeah. I don't know. I don't understand it. I just think it's got to be due to, as you say, successful PR and people wanting to forget the misery of their own lives and have something to look up to and have something to feel proud of.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here at Hidden Files, Dr. Rebecca Masterton. Well, let's take a look at just a few instances of abuse on the Queen's watch, from wars to crackdowns to even changing government. We start off with the Mau Mau uprising, which took place in Kenya from 1952 to 1960. Now, the Kenyans, who were resisting the theft of their lands by the British and working for them as servants, started attacking British interests. Their uprising was met with sheer brutality. Many women were raped with glass bottles. Men were castrated with pliers. Others starved to death. The uprising lasted, as I said, from 1952 to 1960. And then we turn to Northern Ireland. We know that decades the British were involved in Northern Ireland. But in 1972, on Bloody Sunday, the British troops actually cracked down on protesters. Now, this protest, of course, the protesters, demonstrators, were Roman Catholic. That's just one instance of what happened in Northern Ireland. Now we go to, actually, Australia, where in 1975, actually, the Queen was directly involved in a constitutional crisis that took place there. Now, some had said that her role was ceremonial, but we have evidence even from the palace letters, which were just released last year, concerning her involvement in changing an elected government, Australian Prime Minister Gough Whitlam. And, of course, then there is the situation that took place in Nigeria. With Nigeria from 1967 to 1970, Nigeria, a part of the Nigerian region, Biafra, wanted to secede from Nigeria for various reasons. And, of course, the British did not want that to happen because they had control over the Biafra region, which was oil rich, and their British and American oil firms were there, and they wanted to protect the oil at the expense of many people dying during that civil war, which lasted 30 months. And we fast forward all the way to 2003, where we have the beginning of the Iraq War, and we know that the UK was in full support with the United States of that invasion that caused the death, destruction, and misplacement of millions of people. And we know that there were no WMDs now involved in this. And still, as late as last year, the end of last year, right before the beginning of this year, we saw the Queen knight Tony Blair, who was the UK's prime minister, during that time. Tony Blair, who many Brits called a war criminal and want to see him prosecuted for his crimes, and yet the Queen knighted him. So it is very difficult to say, for many, though they may try, that the Queen's role was only ceremonial. Well, let's get our next guest in on this discussion to look at this overall situation further.